The Rise of a Mass Democracy, 1824-1840. In the full enjoyment of the gifts of heaven and the fruits of superior industry, economy, and virtue, every man is equally entitled to protection by law. But when the laws undertake to aid to those natural and just advantages artificial distinctions and exclusive privileges, the humble members of society, the farmers, mechanics, and laborers have a right to complain of the injustice of their government. Andrew Jackson, 1832. The so-called era of good feelings was never entirely tranquil, but even the illusion of national consensus was shattered by the Panic of 1819 and the Missouri Compromise of 1820. Economic distress and the slavery issue raised the political stakes in the 1820s and 1830s. Vigorous political conflict, once feared, came to be celebrated as necessary for the health of democracy. New political parties emerged. New styles of campaigning took hold. A new chapter opened in the history of American politics. The political landscape of 1824 was similar, in its broad outlines, to that of 1796. By 1840 it would be almost unrecognizable. The deference, apathy, and virtually non-existent party organizations of the era of good feelings yielded to the boisterous democracy, frenzied vitality, and strong political parties of the Jacksonian era. The old suspicion of political parties as illegitimate disruptors of society's natural harmony gave way to an acceptance of the sometimes wild contentiousness of political life. In 1828, an energetic new party, the Democrats, captured the White House. By the 1830s, the Democrats faced an equally vigorous opposition party in the form of the Whigs. This two-party system institutionalized divisions that had vexed the revolutionary generation and came to constitute an important part of the nation's checks and balances on political power. New forms of politicking emerged in this era, as candidates used banners, badges, parades, barbecues, free drinks, and baby kissing to get out the vote. Voter turnout rose dramatically. Only about one quarter of eligible voters cast a ballot in the presidential election of 1824, but that proportion doubled in 1828, and in the election of 1840 it reached 78%. Everywhere people flexed their political muscles. The last of the old-style elections was marked by the controversial corrupt bargain of 1824. The woods were full of presidential timber as James Monroe, last of the Virginia dynasty, completed his second term. Four candidates towered above the others: John Quincy Adams of Massachusetts, highly intelligent, experienced, and aloof; Henry Clay of Kentucky, the gamey and gallant Harry of the West; William H. Crawford of Georgia, an able though ailing giant of a man; and Andrew Jackson of Tennessee, the gaunt and gusty hero of New Orleans. All four rivals professed to be Republicans. Well-organized parties had not yet emerged. Their identities were so fuzzy, in fact, that John C. Calhoun appeared as the vice presidential candidate on both the Adams and the Jackson tickets. The results of the noisy campaign were interesting but confusing. Jackson, the war hero, clearly had the strongest personal appeal, especially in the West, where his campaign against the forces of corruption and privilege in government resonated deeply. He polled almost as many popular votes as his next two rivals combined, but he failed to win a majority of the electoral vote. In such a deadlock, the House of Representatives, as directed by the 12th Amendment, must choose among the top three candidates. Clay was thus eliminated, yet as Speaker of the House, he presided over the very chamber that had to pick the winner. The influential Clay was in a position to throw the election to the candidate of his choice. He reached his decision by the process of elimination. Crawford, recently felled by a paralytic stroke, was out of the picture. Clay hated the military chief and Jackson, his archrival for the allegiance of the West. Jackson, in turn, bitterly resented Clay's public denunciation of his Florida foray in 1818. The only candidate left was the puritanical Adams, with whom Clay, a free-living gambler and duelist, had never established cordial personal relations. But the two men had much in common politically. Both were fervid nationalists and advocates of the American system. Shortly before the final balloting of the House, Clay met privately with Adams and assured him of his support. Decision day came early in 1825. The House of Representatives met amid tense excitement, with sick members being carried in on stretchers. On the first ballot, Thanks largely to Clay's behind-the-scenes influence, Adams was elected president. A few days later, the victor announced that Henry Clay would be the new Secretary of State. The office of Secretary of State was the prize plum then, even more so than today. Three of the four preceding secretaries had reached the presidency, and the high cabinet office was regarded as an almost certain pathway to the White House. According to Jackson's supporters, Adams had bribed Clay with the position, making himself the people's second choice, the victor over Jackson, the people's first choice. Masses of angry Jacksonians, most of them common folk, raised a roar of protest against this corrupt bargain. The clamor continued for nearly 4 years. Jackson condemned Clay as the Judas of the West, and John Randolph of Virginia publicly assailed the alliance between the Puritan Adams and the black-legged Clay, who, he added, shines and stinks like rotten mackerel by moonlight. Clay, outraged, challenged Randolph to a duel, though poor marksmanship and shaky nerves rendered the outcome bloodless. No positive evidence has yet been unearthed to prove that Adams and Clay entered into a formal bargain. Clay was a natural choice for Secretary of State, and Adams was both scrupulously honest and not given to patronage. Even if a bargain had been struck, it was not necessarily corrupt. Deals of this nature have long been the stock in trade of politicians. But the outcry over Adams's election showed that change was in the wind. What had once been common practice was now condemned as furtive, elitist, and subversive of democracy. The next president would not be chosen behind closed doors. John Quincy Adams was a chip off the old family glacier. Short, thick-set, and billiard bald, he was even more frigidly austere than his presidential father, John Adams. Shunning people, he often went for early morning swims, sometimes stark naked, in the then pure Potomac River. Essentially a closeted thinker rather than a politician, he was irritable, sarcastic, and tactless. Yet few individuals have ever come to the presidency with a more brilliant record in statecraft, especially in foreign affairs. He ranks as one of the most successful secretaries of state, yet one of the least successful presidents. A man of scrupulous honor, Adams entered upon his 4-year sentence in the White House smarting under charges of bargain, corruption, and usurpation. Fewer than 1/3 of the voters had voted for him. As the first minority president, he would have found it difficult to win popular support even under the most favorable conditions. He did not possess many of the usual arts of the politician and scorned those who did. He had achieved high office by commanding respect rather than by courting popularity. In an earlier era, in aloof John Adams had won the votes of proportive men by sheer ability. But with the dawning age of backslapping and baby-kissing democracy, his cold-fish son could hardly hope for success at the polls. While Adams's enemies accused him of striking a corrupt bargain, his political allies wished that he would strike a few more. Whether through high-mindedness or political ineptitude, Adams resolutely declined to oust efficient officeholders in order to create vacancies for his supporters. During his entire administration, he removed only 12 public servants from the federal payroll. Such stubbornness caused countless Adams followers to throw up their hands in despair. If the president would not reward party workers with political plums, why should they labor to keep him in office? Adams's nationalistic views gave him further woes. Much of the nation was turning away from post-Gent nationalism and toward states' rights and sectionalism. But Adams swam against the tide. Confirmed nationalist that he was, Adams, in his first annual message, urged upon Congress the construction of roads and canals. He renewed George Washington's proposal for a national university and went so far as to advocate federal support for an astronomical observatory. The public reaction to these proposals was prompt and unfavorable. To many workaday Americans grubbing out stubs, astronomical observatories seemed like a scandalous waste of public funds. The South in particular bristled. If the federal government should take on such heavy financial burdens, it would have to continue the hated tariff duties. Worse, if it could meddle in local concerns like education and roads, it might even try to lay its hand on the peculiar institution of black slavery. Adams's land policy likewise antagonized the Westerners. They clamored for wide-open expansion and resented the president's well-meaning attempts to curb feverish speculation in the public domain. The fate of the Cherokee Indians, threatened with eviction from their holdings in Georgia, brought additional bitterness. White Georgians wanted the Cherokees out. The ruggedly honest Adams attempted to deal fairly with the Indians. The Georgia governor, by threatening to resort to arms, successfully resisted the efforts of the Washington government to interpose federal authority on behalf of the Cherokees. Another fateful chapter was thus written in the nullification of the national will, and another nail was driven in Adams's political coffin. The presidential campaign for Andrew Jackson had started early, on February 9, 1825, the day of John Quincy Adams's controversial election by the House, and it continued noisily for nearly 4 years. Even before the election of 1828, the temporarily united Republicans of the era of good feelings had split into two camps with enact Adams as their standard bearer, Jackson heading their ticket. It's were bargain and corruption for Jackson, an all-hey tough hero. Of their openly independent of the common man. The five by the way to right the wrong by was political armor but a winner off the labor of Ives. And Adams, though perhaps an aristocrat, far from curls were to us in 18-uncle politics. Adams would not stoop to gutter tactics, but many of his backers were less squeamish. They described Jackson's mother as a prostitute and his wife as an adult, recounting his numerous duels and brawls and trumpeting his hanging of 6 mutinous militiamen. Jackson men also hid below the belt. President Adams had purchased, with his own money and for his own use, a billiard table and a set of chessmen. In the mouths of rabid Jacksonites, these items became gaming tables and gambling furniture for the presidential palace. Criticism was also directed at the large sums Adams had received over the years in federal salaries, well earned though they had been. He was even accused of having procured a servant girl for the lust of the Russian Tsar, in short, of having served as a pimp. On voting day, the electorate split on largely sectional lines. Jackson's strongest support came from the West and South. The Middle States and the Old Northwest were divided, while Adams won the backing of his own New England and the propertied better elements of the Northeast. But when the popular vote was converted to electoral votes, General Jackson's triumph could not be denied. Old Hickory had trounced Adams by an electoral count of 178-83. Although a considerable part of Jackson's support was lined up by machine politicians in eastern cities, particularly in New York and Pennsylvania, the political center of gravity clearly had shifted away from the conservative eastern seaboard toward the emerging states across the mountains. The new president cut a striking figure, tall, lean, with bushy iron-gray hair brushed high above a prominent forehead, craggy eyebrows, and blue eyes. His irritability and emaciated condition resulted in part from long-term bouts with dysentery, malaria, tuberculosis, and lead poisoning from 2 bullets that he carried in his body from near-fatal duels. His autobiography was written in his lined face. Jackson's upbringing had its shortcomings. Born in the Carolinas an early orphan, mischievous Andy grew up without parental restraints. As a youth he displayed much more interest in brawling and cockfighting than in his scanty opportunities for reading and spelling. Although he eventually learned to express himself in writing with vigor and clarity, his grammar was always rough-hewn and his spelling original, like that of many contemporaries. He sometimes misspelled a word 2 different ways in the same letter. The youthful Carolinian shrewdly moved up west to Tennessee, where fighting was prized above writing. There, through native intelligence, force of personality, and powers of leadership, he became a judge and a member of Congress. Afflicted with a violent temper, he early became involved in a number of duels, stabbings, and bloody frays. His passions were so profound that on occasion he would choke into silence when he tried to speak. The first president from the West, the first nominated at a formal party convention in 1832, and only the second without a college education, Washington was the first. Jackson was unique. His university was adversity. He had risen from the masses, but he was not one of them, except insofar as he shared many of their prejudices. Essentially a frontier aristocrat, he owned many slaves, cultivated broad acres, and lived in one of the finest mansions in America, the Hermitage, near Nashville, Tennessee. More westerner than easterner, more country gentleman than common clay, more courtly than crude, he was hard to fit into a neat category. Jackson's inauguration seemed to symbolize the ascendancy of the masses. Hickoryites poured into Washington from far away, sleeping on hotel floors and in hallways. They were curious to see their hero take office and perhaps hope to pick up a well-paying office for themselves. Nobody's mingled with notables as the White House, for the first time, was thrown open to the multitude. A milling crowd of rubbernecking clerks and shopkeepers, hobnailed artisans, and grimy laborers surged in, allegedly wrecking the china and furniture and threatening the people's champion with cracked ribs. Jackson was hastily spirited through a side door, and the White House miraculously emptied itself when the word was passed that huge bowls of well-spiked punch had been placed on the lawns. Such was the inaugural brawl. To conservatives, this orgy seemed like the end of the world. King Mob reigned triumphant as Jacksonian vulgarity replaced Jeffersonian simplicity. Faint-hearted traditionalists shuddered, drew their blinds, and recalled with trepidation the opening scenes of the French Revolution. Once in power, the Democrats, famously suspicious of the federal government, demonstrated that they were not above striking some bargains of their own. Under Jackson, the spoils system, that is, rewarding political supporters with public office, was introduced into the federal government on a large scale. The basic idea was as old as politics. Its name came later from Senator William Marcy's classic remark in 1832, "To the victor belong the spoils of the enemy." The system had already secured a firm hold in New York and Pennsylvania, where well-greased machines ladled out the gravy of office. Jackson defended the spoils system on Democratic grounds. "Every man is as good as his neighbor," he declared, "perhaps equally better." As this was believed to be so, and as the routine of office was thought to be simple enough for any upstanding American to learn quickly, why encourage the development of an aristocratic, bureaucratic, office-holding class? Better to bring in new blood, he argued. Each generation deserved its turn at the public trough. Washington was due, it is true, for a house cleaning. No party overturn had occurred since the defeat of the Federalists in 1800, and even that had not produced wholesale evictions. A few officeholders, their commissions signed by President Washington, were lingering on into their 80s, drawing breath and salary but doing little else. But the spoils system was less about finding new blood than about rewarding old cronies. "Throw their rascals out and put our rascals in," the Democrats were essentially saying. The questions asked of each appointee were not, "What can he do for the country?" but, "What has he done for the party? Or is he loyal to Jackson?" Scandal inevitably accompanied the new system. Men who had openly bought their posts by campaign contributions were appointed to high office. Illiterates, incompetents, and plain crooks were given positions of public trust. Men on the make lusted for the spoils, rather than the toils, of office. Samuel Swartwout, despite ample warnings of his untrustworthiness, was awarded the lucrative post of collector of the customs of the Port of New York. Nearly 9 years later, he Swartwouted out for England, leaving his accounts more than $1 million short, the first person to steal $1 million from the Washington government. But despite its undeniable abuse, the spoils system was an important element of the emerging two-party order, cementing as it did loyalty to party over competing claims based on economic class or geographic region. The promise of patronage provided a compelling reason for Americans to pick a party and stick with it through thick and thin. The touchy tariff issue had been one of John Quincy Adams's biggest headaches. Now Andrew Jackson felt his predecessor's pain. Tariffs protected American industry against competition from European manufactured goods, but they also drove up prices for all Americans and invited retaliatory tariffs on American agricultural exports abroad. The Middle States had long been supporters of protectionist tariffs. In the 1820s, influential New Englanders like Daniel Webster gave up their traditional defense of free trade to support higher tariffs, too. The wool and textile industries were booming, and forward-thinking Yankees came to believe that their future prosperity would flow from the factory rather than from the sea. In 1824, Congress had increased the general tariff significantly, but wool manufacturers bleated for still higher barriers. Ardent Jacksonites now played a cynical political game. They promoted a high tariff bill, expecting to be defeated, which would give a black eye to President Adams. To their surprise, the tariff passed in 1828, and Andrew Jackson inherited the political hot potato. Southerners, as heavy consumers of manufactured goods with little manufacturing industry of their own, were hostile to tariffs. They were particularly shocked by what they regarded as the outrageous rates of the tariff of 1828. Hotheads branded it the Black Tariff or the Tariff of Abominations. Several southern states adopted formal protests. In South Carolina, flags were lowered to half-mast. "Let the New England beware how she imitates the old," cried one eloquent South Carolinian. Why did the South react so angrily against the tariff? Southerners believed, not illogically, that the Yankee tariff discriminated against them. The bustling Northeast was experiencing a boom in manufacturing, the developing West was prospering from rising property values and a multiplying population, and the energetic Southwest was expanding into virgin cotton lands. But the Old South was falling on hard times, and the tariff provided a convenient and plausible scapegoat. Southerners sold their cotton and other farm produce in a world market completely unprotected by tariffs, but were forced to buy their manufactured goods in an American market heavily protected by tariffs. Protectionism protected Yankee and Middle State manufacturers. The farmers and planters of the Old South felt they were stuck with the bill. But much deeper issues underlay the Southern outcry, in particular, a growing anxiety about possible federal interference with the institution of slavery. The congressional debate on the Missouri Compromise had kindled those anxieties, and they were further fanned by an aborted slave rebellion in Charleston in 1822, led by a free black named Enmark Vesey. The South Carolinians, still closely tied to the British West Indies, also knew full well that their Slavyowning West Indian cousins were feeling the mounting pressure of British abolitionism on the London government. Abolitionism in America might similarly use the power of the government in Washington to suppress slavery in the South. If so, now was the time, and the tariff was the issue, to take a strong stand on principle against all federal encroachments on states' rights. South Carolinians took the lead in protesting against the tariff of abominations. Their legislature went so far as to publish in 1828, though without formal endorsement, a pamphlet known as the South Carolina Exposition. It had been secretly written by John C. Calhoun, one of the few top-flight political theorists ever produced by America. As vice president, he was forced to conceal his authorship. The exposition denounced the recent tariff as unjust and unconstitutional. Going a stride beyond the Kentucky and Virginia resolutions of 1798, it bluntly and explicitly proposed that the states should nullify the tariff, that is, they should declare it null and void within their borders. The stage was set for a showdown. Through Jackson's first term, the nullifiers' nullies, they were called, tried strenuously to muster the necessary two-thirds vote for nullification in the South Carolina legislature. But they were blocked by a determined minority of unionists, scorned as submission men. Back in Washington, Congress tipped the balance by passing the new tariff of 1832. Though it pared away the worst abominations of 1828, it was still frankly protective and fell far short of meeting Southern demands. Worse yet, to many Southerners it had a disquieting air of permanence. South Carolina was now nerved for drastic action. Nullifiers and unionists clashed head-on in the state election of 1832. Nullies, defiantly wearing palmetto ribbons on their hats to mark their loyalty to the palmetto state, emerged with more than a two-thirds majority. The state legislature then called for a special convention. Several weeks later, the delegates, meeting in Columbia, solemnly declared the existing tariff to be null and void within South Carolina. As a further act of defiance, the convention threatened to take South Carolina out of the Union if Washington attempted to collect the customs duties by force. Such tactics might have intimidated John Quincy Adams, but Andrew Jackson was the wrong president to stare down. The cantankerous general was not a diehard supporter of the tariff, but he would not permit defiance or disunion. His military instincts rasped, Jackson privately threatened to invade the state and have the nullifiers hanged. In public he was only slightly less pugnacious. He dispatched naval and militia reinforcements to the Palmetto State, while quietly preparing a sizable army. He also issued a ringing proclamation against nullification, to which the governor of South Carolina, former Senator Robert Y. Hayne, responded with a counterproclamation. The lines were drawn. If civil war were to be avoided, one side would have to surrender, or both would have to compromise. Conciliatory Henry Clay of Kentucky, now in the Senate, stepped forward. An unforgiving foe of Jackson, he had no desire to see his old enemy win new laurels by crushing the Carolinians and returning with the scalp of Calhoun dangling from his belt. Although himself a supporter of tariffs, the gallant Kentuckian therefore threw his influence behind a compromise bill that would gradually reduce the tariff of 1832 by about 10% over a period of 8 years. By 1842 the rates would be back at the mildly protective level of 1816. The compromise tariff of 1833 finally squeezed through Congress. Debate was bitter, with most of the opposition naturally coming from protectionist New England and the Middle States. Calhoun in the South favored the compromise, so it was evident that Jackson would not have to use firearms and rope. But at the same time, and partly as a face-saving device, Congress passed a force bill, known among Carolinians as the Bloody Bill. It authorized the president to use the army and naval, if necessary, to collect federal tariff duties. South Carolinians welcomed this opportunity to extricate themselves from a dangerously tight corner without loss of face. To the consternation of the Calhounites, no other southern states had sprung to their support, though Georgia and Virginia toyed with the idea. Moreover, an appreciable unionist minority within South Carolina was gathering guns, organizing militia, and nailing stars and stripes to flagpoles. Faced with civil war within and invasion from without, the Columbia Convention met again and repealed the Ordinance of Nullification. As a final but futile gesture of fist-shaking, it nullified the unnecessary force bill and adjourned. Neither Jackson nor the Nullies won a clear-cut victory in 1833. Clay was the true hero of the hour, hailed in Charleston and Boston alike for saving the country. Armed conflict had been avoided, but the fundamental issues had not been resolved. When next the Nullies and the Union clashed, compromise would prove more elusive. Jackson's Democrats were committed to Western expansion, but such expansion necessarily meant confrontation with the current inhabitants of the land. More than 125,000 Native Americans lived in the forests and prairies east of the Mississippi in the 1820s. Federal policy toward them varied. Beginning of the 1790s, the Washington government ostensibly recognized the tribes as separate nations and agreed to acquire land from them only through formal treaties. The Indians were shrewd and stubborn negotiators, but this availed them little when Americans routinely violated their own covenants, erasing and redrawing treaty line after treaty line on their maps as white settlement pushed west. Many white Americans felt respect and admiration for the Indians and believed that the Native Americans could be assimilated into white society. Much energy therefore was devoted to civilizing and Christianizing the Indians. The Society for Propagating the Gospel Among Indians was founded in 1787, and many denominations sent missionaries into Indian villages. In 1793, Congress appropriated $20,000 for the promotion of literacy and agricultural and vocational instruction among the Indians. Although many tribes violently resisted white encroachment, others followed the path of accommodation. The Cherokees of Georgia made especially remarkable efforts to learn the ways of the whites. They gradually abandoned their semi-nomadic life and adopted a system of settled agriculture and a notion of private property. Missionaries opened schools among the Cherokees, and the Indian Sequoia devised a Cherokee alphabet. In 1808 the Cherokee National Council legislated a written legal code, and in 1827 it adopted a written constitution that provided for executive, legislative, and judicial branches of government. Some Cherokees became prosperous cotton planters and even turned to slaveholding. Nearly 1,300 black slaves toiled for their Native American masters in the Cherokee Nation in the 1820s. For these efforts the Cherokees, along with the Creeks, Choctaws, Chickasaws, and Seminoles, were numbered by whites among the five civilized tribes. All this embrace of civilization apparently was not good enough for whites. In 1828 the Georgia legislature declared the Cherokee Tribal Council illegal and asserted its own jurisdiction over Indian affairs and Indian lands. The Cherokees appealed this move to the Supreme Court, which thrice upheld the rights of the Indians, but President Jackson, who clearly wanted to open Indian lands to white settlement, refused to recognize the court's decisions. In a callous jibe at the Indians' defender, Jackson allegedly snapped, "John Marshall has made his decision. Now let him enforce it." Feeling some obligation to rescue this much injured race, Jackson proposed a bodily removal of the remaining eastern tribes, chiefly Cherokees, Creeks, Choctaws, Chickasaws, and Seminoles, beyond the Mississippi. Emigration was supposed to be voluntary because it would be cruel and unjust to compel the Aborigines to abandon the graves of their fathers. Jackson evidently consoled himself with the belief that the Indians could preserve their native cultures in the wide open West. Jackson's policy led to the forced uprooting of more than 100,000 Indians. In 1830, Congress passed the Indian Removal Act, providing for the transplanting of all Indian tribes then resident east of the Mississippi. Ironically, the heaviest blows fell on the five civilized tribes. In the ensuing decade, countless Indians died on forced marches to the newly established Indian Territory, where they were to be permanently free of white encroachments. The Bureau of Indian Affairs was established in 1836 to administer relations with America's original inhabitants. But as the land-hungry Pale Faces pushed west faster than anticipated, the government's guarantees went up in smoke. The permanent frontier lasted about 15 years. Suspicious of white intentions from the start, Sauk and Fox braves from Illinois and Wisconsin, ably led by Black Hawk, resisted eviction. They were bloodily crushed in 1832 by regular troops, including Lieutenant Jefferson Davis of Mississippi, and by volunteers, including Captain Abraham Lincoln of Illinois. In Florida, the Seminole Indians, joined by runaway black slaves, retreated to the swampy Everglades. For 7 years they waged a bitter guerrilla war that took the lives of some 1,500 soldiers. The spirit of the Seminoles was broken in 1837, when the American field commander treacherously seized their leader, Osceola, under a flag of truce. The war dragged on for 5 more years, but the Seminoles were doomed. Some fled deeper into the Everglades, where their descendants now live, but about 4/5 of them were moved to present-day Oklahoma, where several thousand of the tribe survive. President Jackson did not hate all banks and all businesses, but he distrusted monopolistic banking and overbig businesses, as did his followers. A man of virulent dislikes, he came to share the prejudices of his own West against the moneyed monster known as the Bank of the United States. What made the bank a monster in Jackson's eyes? The national government minted gold and silver coins in the mid-19th century but did not issue paper money. Paper notes were printed by private banks. Their value fluctuated with the health of the bank and the amount of money printed, giving private bankers considerable power over the nation's economy. No bank in America had more power than the Bank of the United States. In many ways, the bank acted like a branch of government. It was the principal depository for the funds of the Washington government and controlled much of the nation's gold and silver. Its notes, unlike those of many smaller banks, were stable in value. A source of credit and stability, the bank was an important and useful part of the nation's expanding economy. But the Bank of the United States was a private institution, accountable not to the people, but to its elite circle of moneyed investors. Its president, the brilliant but arrogant Nicholas Biddle, held an immense, and to many unconstitutional, amount of power over the nation's financial affairs. Enemies of the bank dubbed him Tsar Nicholas I and called the bank a hydra of corruption, a serpent that grew new heads whenever old ones were cut off. To some, the bank's very existence seemed to sin against the egalitarian cradle of American democracy. The conviction formed the deepest source of Jackson's opposition. The bank also won no friends in the West by foreclosing on many Western farms and draining tribute into Eastern coffers. Profit, not public service, was its first priority. The bank war erupted in 1832, when Daniel Webster and Henry Clay presented Congress with a bill to renew the Bank of the United States charter. The charter was not set to expire until 1836, but Clay pushed for renewal 4 years early to make it an election issue in 1832. As Jackson's leading rival for the presidency, Clay, with fateful blindness, looked upon the bank issue as a surefire winner. Clay's scheme was to ram a re-charter bill through Congress and then send it on to the White House. If Jackson signed it, he would alienate his worshipful Western followers. If he vetoed it, as seemed certain, he would presumably lose the presidency in the forthcoming election by alienating the wealthy and influential groups in the East. Clay seems not to have fully realized that the best people were now only a minority and that they generally feared Jackson anyhow. The recharter bill slid through Congress on greased skids, as planned, but was killed by a scorching veto from Jackson. The old hero declared the monopolistic bank to be unconstitutional. Of course, the Supreme Court had earlier declared it constitutional in the case of McCulloch v. Maryland, but Jackson acted as though he regarded the executive branch as superior to the judicial branch. The old general growled privately, "The bank is trying to kill me, but I will kill it." Jackson's veto message reverberated with constitutional consequences. It not only squashed the bank bill but vastly amplified the power of the presidency. All previous vetoes had rested almost exclusively on questions of constitutionality, but though Jackson invoked the Constitution in his bank veto message, he essentially argued that he was vetoing the bill because he personally found it harmful to the nation. In effect, he was claiming for the president alone a power equivalent to 2/3 of the votes in Congress. If the legislative and executive branches were partners in government, he implied, the president was unmistakably the senior partner. Henry Clay's political instincts continued to fail him. Delighted with the financial fallacies of Jackson's message but blind to its political appeal, he arranged to have thousands of copies printed as a campaign document. The president's sweeping accusations may indeed have seemed demagogic to the moneyed interests of the East, but they made perfect sense to the common people. The bank issue was now thrown into the noisy arena of the presidential contest of 1832. Clay and Jackson were the chief gladiators in the looming electoral combat. The grizzled old general, who had earlier favored one term for a president and rotation in office, was easily persuaded by his cronies not to rotate himself out of office. Presidential power is a heady brew and can be habit-forming. The ensuing campaign was ruckus. The old hero's adherents again raised the hickory pole and bellowed, "Jackson forever, go the whole hog." And admirers of Clay shouted, "Freedom and Clay," while his detractors harped on his dueling, gambling, cockfighting, and fast living. Novel features made the campaign of 1832's Cholly memorable. For the first time, a third party entered the field, the newborn anti-Masonic party, which opposed the influence and fearsome secrecy of the Masonic order. Energized by the mysterious disappearance and probable murder in 1826 of a New Yorker who was threatening to expose the secret rituals of the Masons, the anti-Masonic party quickly became a potent political force in New York and spread its influence throughout the Middle Atlantic and New England states. The anti-Masons appealed to long-standing American suspicions of secret societies, which they condemned as citadels of privilege and monopoly, a note that harmonized with the Democratic chorus of the Jacksonians. But since Jackson himself was a Mason and publicly gloried in his membership, the anti-Masonic party was also an anti-Jackson party. The anti-Masons also attracted support from many evangelical Protestant groups seeking to use political power to effect moral and religious reforms, such as prohibiting mail delivery on Sunday and otherwise keeping the Sabbath holy. This moral disembodiedness was anathema to the Jacksonians, who were generally opposed to all government meddling in social and economic life. A further novelty of the presidential contest in 1832 was the calling of national nominating conventions, three of them to name candidates. The anti-Masons and a group of national Republicans added still another innovation when they adopted formal platforms, publicizing their positions on the issues. Henry Clay and his overconfident national Republicans enjoyed impressive advantages. Ample funds flowed into their campaign chest, including $50,000 in life insurance from the Bank of the United States. Most of the newspaper editors, some of them bought with Biddle's bank loans, dipped their pens in acid when they wrote of Jackson. Yet Jackson, idol of the masses, easily defeated the big-money Kentuckian. A Jacksonian wave again swept over the West and South, surged into Pennsylvania and New York, and even washed into Rock Ridge, New England. The popular vote stood at 687,502 to 530,189 for Jackson. The electoral count was a lopsided 219 to 49. Its charter denied, the Bank of the United States was due to expire in 1836. But Jackson was not one to let the financial octopus die in peace. He was convinced that he now had a mandate from the voters for its extermination, and he feared that the slippery Biddle might try to manipulate the bank as he did so as to force its recharter. Jackson therefore decided in 1833 to bury the bank for good by removing federal deposits from its vaults. He proposed depositing no more funds with Biddle and gradually shrinking existing deposits by using them to defray the day-to-day expenses of the government. By slowly siphoning off the government's funds, he would bleed the bank dry and ensure its demise. Removing the deposits involved nasty complications. Even the president's closest advisors opposed the seemingly unnecessary, possibly unconstitutional, and certainly vindictive policy. Jackson, his dander up, was forced to reshuffle his cabinet twice before he could find a secretary of the treasury who would bend to his iron will. A desperate Biddle called in his bank's loans, evidently hoping to illustrate the bank's importance by producing a minor financial crisis. A number of wobblier banks were driven to the wall by Biddle's panic, but Jackson's resolution was firm. If anything, the vengeful conduct of the dying monster seemed to justify the earlier accusations of its adversaries. But the death of the Bank of the United States left a financial vacuum in the American economy and kicked off a lurching cycle of booms and busts. Surplus federal funds were placed in several dozen state institutions, the so-called pet banks, chosen for their pro-Jackson sympathies. Without a sober central bank in control, the pet banks and smaller wildcat banks, fly-by-night operations that often consisted of little more than a few chairs and a suitcase full of printed notes, flooded the country with paper money. Jackson tried to rein in the runaway economy in 1836, the year Biddle's bank breathed its last. Wildcat currency had become so unreliable, especially in the West, that Jackson authorized the Treasury to issue a specie circular, a decree that required all public lands to be purchased with hard, or metallic, money. This drastic step slammed the brakes on the speculative boom, a neck-snapping change of direction that contributed to a financial panic and crash in 1837. But by then Jackson had retired to his Nashville home, hailed as the hero of his age. His successor would have to deal with the damage. New political parties were gelling as the 1830s lengthened. As early as 1828, the Democratic Republicans of Jackson had unashamedly adopted the once tainted name Democrats. Jackson's opponents, fuming at his iron-fisted exercise of presidential power, condemned him as King Andrew I and began to coalesce as the Whigs, a name deliberately chosen to recollect 18th-century British and Revolutionary American opposition to the monarchy. The Whig Party contained so many diverse ailments that it was mocked at first as an organized incompatibility. Hatred of Jackson and his executive usurpation was its only apparent cement in its formative days. The Whigs first emerged as an identifiable group in the Senate, where Clay, Webster, and Calhoun joined forces in 1834 to pass a motion censuring Jackson for his single-handed removal of federal deposits from the Bank of the United States. Thereafter, the Whigs rapidly evolved into a potent national political force by attracting other groups alienated by Jackson, supporters of Clay's American system, Southern states writers offended by Jackson's stand on nullification, the larger Northern industrialists and merchants, and eventually many of the evangelical Protestants associated with the anti-Masonic party. Whigs thought of themselves as conservatives, yet they were progressive in their support of active government programs and reforms. Instead of boundless territorial acquisition, they called for internal improvements like canals, railroads, and telegraph lines, and they supported institutions like prisons, asylums, and public schools. The Whigs welcomed the market economy, drawing support from manufacturers in the North, planters in the South, and merchants and bankers in all sections. But they were not simply a party of wealthy fat cats, however dearly the Democrats wanted to paint them as such. By absorbing the anti-Masonic party, the Whigs blunted much of the Democratic appeal to the common man. The egalitarian anti-Masons portrayed Jackson, and particularly his New York successor Martin Van Buren, as imperious aristocrats. This turned Jacksonian rhetoric on its head. Now the Whigs claimed to be the defenders of the common man and declared the Democrats the party of cronyism and corruption. The smooth-tongued and keen-witted vice president, Martin Van Buren of New York, was Jackson's choice for appointment as his successor in 1836. The hollow-cheeked Jackson, now nearing 70, was too old and ailing to consider a third term. but he was not loath to try to serve a third term through Van Buren, something of a yes man. Leaving nothing to chance, Jackson carefully rigged the nominating convention and rammed his favor down the throats of the delegates. Van Buren was supported by the Jacksonites without wild enthusiasm, even though he had promised to tread generally in the military booted footsteps of his predecessor. As the election neared, the still ramshackle organization of the Whigs showed in their inability to nominate a single presidential candidate. Their long-shot strategy was instead to run several prominent favored sons, each with a different regional appeal, and hope to scatter the votes so that no candidate would win a majority. The deadlock would then have to be broken by the House of Representatives, where the Whigs might have a chance. With Henry Clay rudely elbowed aside, the leading Whig favorite son was heavy-jawed General William Henry Harrison of Ohio, hero of the Battle of Tippecanoe. The fine-spun schemes of the Whigs availed nothing, however. Van Buren, the dapper little magician, squirmed into office by the close popular vote of 765,483 to 739,795, but by the comfortable margin of 170 to 124 votes for all the Whigs combined in the Electoral College. Examining the evidence. Satiric banknote, 1837. Political humor can take more forms than the commonly seen caustic cartoon. Occasionally historians stumble upon other examples, such as this fake banknote. A jibe at Andrew Jackson's money policies, it appeared in New York in 1837 after Jackson's insistence on shutting down the Bank of the United States resulted in the suspension of specie payments. The clever creator of the satiric banknote for 6 cents left little doubt about the worthlessness of the note or Jackson's responsibility for it. The 6 cents payable by the Humba Glory Bank, whose symbols were a donkey and a hickory leaf or old hickory, were redeemable in mint drops or glory at cost. The bank's cashier was Cunning Reuben, possibly an anti-Semitic allusion to usurious Jewish bankers. Can you identify other ways in which this document takes aim at Jackson's banking policies? What symbols did the note's creator assume the public would comprehend? Big woes for the little magician. Martin Van Buren, 8th president, was the first to be born under the American flag. Short and slender, bland and bald, the adroit little New Yorker has been described as a first-class second-rate man. An accomplished strategist and spoilsman, the Wizard of Albany, he was also a statesman of wide experience in both legislative and administrative life. In intelligence, people felt let down. Inheriting Andrew Jackson's mantle without his popularity, Van Buren also inherited the ex-president's numerous and vengeful enemies. Van Buren's 4 years overflowed with toil and trouble. A rebellion in Canada in 1837 stirred up ugly incidents along the northern frontier and threatened to trigger war with Britain. The president's attempt to play a neutral game led to the wail, "Woe to Martin Van Buren!" The anti-slavery agitators in the North were in full cry. Among other grievances, they were condemning the prospective annexation of Texas. Worst of all, Jackson bequeathed to Van Buren the makings of a searing depression. Much of Van Buren's energy had to be devoted to the purely negative task of battling the panic, and there were not enough rabbits in the little magician's tall silk hat. Hard times ordinarily blight the reputation of a president, and Van Buren was no exception. The panic of 1837 was a symptom of the financial sickness of the times. Its basic cause was rampant speculation prompted by a mania of get-rich-quickism. Gamblers in western lands were doing a land office business on borrowed capital, much of it in the shaky currency of wildcat banks. The speculative craze spread to canals, roads, railroads, and slaves. But speculation alone did not cause the crash. Jacksonian finance, including the bank war and the specie circular, gave an additional jolt to an already teetering structure. Failures of wheat crops, ravaged by the Hessian fly, deepened the distress. Grain prices were forced so high that mobs in New York City, 3 weeks before Van Buren took the oath, stormed warehouses and broke open flour barrels. The panic really began before Jackson left office, but its full fury burst about Van Buren's bewildered head. Financial stringency abroad likewise endangered America's economic house of cards. Late in 1836, the failure of two prominent British banks created tremors, and these in turn caused British investors to call in foreign loans. The resulting pinch in the United States, combined with other setbacks, heralded the beginning of the panic. Europe's economic distresses have often become America's distresses, for every major American financial panic has been affected by conditions overseas. Hardship was acute and widespread. American banks collapsed by the hundreds, including some pet banks, which carried down with them several million in government funds. Commodity prices drooped, sales of public lands fell off, and customs revenues dried to a rivulet. Factories closed their doors, and unemployed workers milled in the streets. The Whigs came forward with proposals for active government remedies for the economy's ills. They called for the expansion of bank credit, higher tariffs, and subsidies for internal improvements. But Van Buren, shackled by the Jacksonian philosophy of keeping the government's paws off the economy, spurned all such ideas. The beleaguered Van Buren tried to apply vintage Jacksonian medicine to the ailing economy through his controversial divorce bill. Convinced that some of the financial fever was fed by the injection of federal funds into private banks, he championed the principle of divorcing the government from banking altogether. By establishing a so-called independent treasury, the government could lock its surplus money in vaults in several of the larger cities. Government funds would thus be safe, but they would also be denied to the banking system as reserves, thereby shriveling available credit resources. Van Buren's divorce scheme was never highly popular. His fellow Democrats, many of whom longed for the risky but lush days of the pet banks, supported it only lukewarmly. The Whigs condemned it, primarily because it squelched their hopes for a revived Bank of the United States. After a prolonged struggle, the Independent Treasury Bill passed Congress in 1840. Repealed the next year by the victorious Whigs, the scheme was reenacted by the triumphant Democrats in 1846 and then continued until the Republicans instituted a network of national banks during the Civil War. Americans, greedy for land, continued to covet the vast expanse of Texas, which the United States had abandoned to Spain when acquiring Florida in 1819. The Spanish authorities wanted to populate this virtually unpeopled area, but before they could carry through their contemplated plans, the Mexicans won their independence. A new regime in Mexico City thereupon concluded arrangements in 1823 for granting a huge tract of land to Stephen Austin, with the understanding that he would bring into Texas 300 American families. Immigrants were to be of the established Roman Catholic faith and upon settlement were to become properly Mexicanized. These two stipulations were largely ignored. Hardy Texas pioneers remained Americans at heart, resenting the trammels imposed by a foreign government. They were especially annoyed by the presence of Mexican soldiers, many of whom were ragged ex-convicts. Energetic and prolific, Texan Americans numbered about 30,000 by 1835. Most of them were law-abiding, God-fearing people, but some of them had left the states only one or two jumps ahead of the sheriff. GTT gone to Texas became current descriptive slang. Among the adventurers were Davy Crockett, the famous rifleman, and Jim Bowie, the presumed inventor of the murderous knife that bears his name. Bowie's blade was widely known in the Southwest as a genuine Arkansas toothpick. A distinguished latecomer and leader was an ex-governor of Tennessee, Sam Houston. His life had been temporarily shattered in 1829 when his bride of a few weeks left him and he took up transient residence with the Arkansas Indians, who dubbed him Big Drunk. He subsequently took the Pledge of Temperance. The pioneer individualists who came to Texas were not easy to push around. Friction rapidly increased between Mexicans and Texans over issues such as slavery, immigration, and local rights. Slavery was a particularly touchy topic. Mexico emancipated its slaves in 1830 and prohibited the further importation of slaves into Texas, as well as further colonization by troublesome Americans. The Texans refused to honor these decrees. They kept their slaves in bondage, and new American settlers kept bringing more slaves into Texas. When Stephen Austin went to Mexico City in 1833 to negotiate these differences with the Mexican government, the dictator Santa Anna clapped him in jail for 8 months. The explosion finally came in 1835, when Santa Anna wiped out all local rights and started to raise an army to suppress the upstart Texans. Early in 1836, the Texans declared their independence, unfurled their Lone Star flag, and named Sam Houston commander-in-chief. Santa Anna, at the head of about 6,000 men, swept ferociously into Texas, trapping a band of nearly 200 pugnacious Texans at the Alamo in San Antonio. He wiped them out to a man after a 13-day siege. Their commander, Colonel W.B. Travis, had declared, "I shall never surrender nor retreat victory or death." A short time later, a band of about 400 surrounded and defeated American volunteers, having thrown down their arms at Goliad, were butchered as pirates. All these operations further delayed the Mexican advance and galvanized American opposition. Slain heroes like Jim Bowie and Davy Crockett, well known in life, became legendary in death. Texan war cries remember the Alamo. Remember Goliad. And death to Santa Anna. Swept up into the United States. Scores of vengeful Americans seized their rifles and rushed to the aid of relatives, friends, and compatriots. General Sam Houston's small army retreated to the east, luring Santa Anna to San Jacinto, near the site of the city that now bears Houston's name. The Mexicans numbered about 1,300 men, the Texans about 900. Suddenly, on April 21, 1836, Houston turned. Taking full advantage of the Mexican siesta, the Texans wiped out the pursuing force and captured Santa Anna, who was found cowering in the tall grass near the battlefield. Confronted with thirsty Bowie knives, the quaking dictator was speedily induced to sign two treaties. By their terms he agreed to withdraw Mexican troops and to recognize the Rio Grande as the extreme southwestern boundary of Texas. When released, he repudiated the agreement as illegal because it was extorted under duress. These events put the U.S. government in a sticky situation. The Texans, though courageous, could hardly have won their independence without the help and men and supplies from their American cousins. The Washington government, as the Mexicans bitterly complained, had a solemn obligation under international law to enforce its leaky neutrality statutes. But American public opinion, overwhelmingly favorable to the Texans, openly nullified the existing legislation. The federal authorities were powerless to act, and on the day before he left office in 1837, President Jackson even extended the right hand of recognition to the Lone Star Republic, led by his old comrade in arms against the Indians, Sam Houston. Many Texans wanted not just recognition of their independence but outright union with the United States. What nation in its right mind, they reasoned, would refuse so lavish a dowry? The radiant Texas bride, officially petitioning for annexation in 1837, presented herself for marriage. But the expectant groom, Uncle Sam, was jerked back by the black hand of the slavery issue. Anti-slavery crusaders in the North were opposing annexation with increasing vehemence. They contended that the whole scheme was merely a conspiracy cooked up by the Southern slavocracy to bring new slave pens into the Union. At first glance, the slavery plot charge seemed plausible. Most of the early settlers in Texas, as well as American volunteers during the Revolution, had come from the states of the South and Southwest. But scholars have concluded that the settlement of Texas was merely the normal and inexorable march of the westward movement. Most of the immigrants came from the South and Southwest simply because these states were closer. The explanation was proximity rather than conspiracy. Yet the fact remained that many Texans were slaveholders, and admitting Texas to the Union inescapably meant enlarging American slavery. Martin Van Buren was renominated by the Democrats in 1840. Albeit without terrific enthusiasm. The party had no acceptable alternative to what the Whigs called Martin Van Ruin. The Whigs, hungering for the spoils of office, scented victory in the breeze. Pangs of the panic were still being felt, and voters blamed their woes on the party in power. Learning from their mistake in 1836, the Whigs united behind one candidate, Ohio's William Henry Harrison. He was not their ablest statesman, that would have been Daniel Webster or Henry Clay, but he was believed to be their ablest vote-getter. The aging hero, nearly 68 when the campaign ended, was known for his successes against Indians and the British at the battles of Tippecanoe and the Thames. Harrison's views on current issues were only vaguely known. Old Tippecanoe was nominated primarily because he was issueless and enemyless, a tested recipe for electoral success that still appeals today. John Tyler of Virginia, an afterthought, was selected as his vice presidential running mate. The Whigs, eager to avoid offense, published no official platform, hoping to sweep their hero into office with a frothy huzzah for Harrison campaign reminiscent of Jackson's triumph in 1828. A dull-witted Democratic editor played directly into Whig hands. Stupidly insulting the West, he lampooned Harrison as an impoverished old farmer who should be content with a pension, a log cabin, and a barrel of hard cider, the poor Westerner's champagne. Whigs gleefully adopted honest hard cider and the sturdy log cabin as symbols of their campaign. Harrisonites portrayed their hero as the poor farmer of North Bend, who had been called from his cabin and his plow to drive corrupt Jackson spoilsmen from the presidential palace. They denounced Van Buren as a supercilious aristocrat, a simpering dandy who wore corsets and ate French food from golden plates. As a jeering Whig campaign song proclaimed, "Old Tip, he wears a homespun shirt, he has no ruffled shirt, wort, wort. But Matt, he has the golden plate, and he's a little squirt, wort, wort." The Whig campaign was a masterpiece of inane hoopla. Log cabins were dished up in every conceivable form. Bowling Whigs, stimulated by fortified cider, rolled huge inflated balls from village to village and state to state, balls that represented the snowballing major itty for Tippecanoe and Tyler too. In truth, Harrison was not low-born, but from one of the FFVS first families of Virginia. He was not poverty-stricken. He did not live in a one-room log cabin, but rather in a 16-room mansion on a 3,000-acre farm. He did not swill down gallons of hard cider, he evidently preferred whiskey. And he did not plow his fields with his own huge paws. But such details had not mattered when General Jackson rode to victory, and they did not matter now. The Democrats that harassed Jackson into the White House in 1828 now discovered to their chagrin that whooping it up for a backwoods Westerner was a game two could play. Harrison won by the surprisingly close margin of 1,274,624 to 1,127,781 popular votes, but by an overwhelming electoral margin of 234 to 60. With hardly a real issue debated, though with hard times blighting the incumbent's fortunes, Van Buren was washed out of Washington on a wave of apple juice. The hard chiderite had apparently received a mandate to tear down the White House and erect a log cabin. Although campaigners in 1840 did their best to bury substantive issues beneath the ballyhoo, voters actually faced a stark choice between two economic visions of how to cope with the nation's first major depression. Whigs sought to expand and stimulate the economy, while Democrats favored retrenchment and an end to high-flying banks and aggressive corporations. The election of 1840 conclusively demonstrated two major changes in American politics since the era of good feelings. The first was the triumph of a populist Democratic style. Democracy had been something of a taint in the days of the lordly Federalists. Martha Washington, the first lady, was shocked after a presidential reception to find a greasy smear on the wallpaper, left there, she was sure, by an uninvited filthy Democrat. But by the 1840s, aristocracy was the taint, and democracy was respectable. Politicians were now forced to curry favor with the voting masses. Lucky indeed was the aspiring office-seeker who could boast of birth in a log cabin. In 1840, Daniel Webster publicly apologized for not being able to claim so humble a birthplace, though he quickly added that his brothers could. Hopelessly handicapped was the candidate who appeared to be too clean, too well-dressed, too grammatical, too highbrowishly intellectual. In truth, most high political offices continued to be filled by leading citizens. But now these wealthy and prominent men had to forsake all social pretensions and cultivate the common touch if they hoped to win elections. Snobbish bigwigs, unhappy over the change, sneered at coonskin congressmen and at the newly enfranchised bipeds of the forest. To them the tyranny of king numbers was no less offensive than that of King George. But these critics protested in vain. The common man was at last moving to the center of the national political stage, the sturdy American who donned coarse trousers rather than buff breeches, who sported a coonskin cap rather than a silk top hat, and who wore no man's collar, often not even one of his own. Instead of the old divine right of kings, America was now bowing to the divine right of the people. The second dramatic change resulting from the 1840 election was the formation of a vigorous and durable two-party system. The Jeffersonians of an earlier day had been so successful in absorbing the programs of their Federalist opponents that a full-blown two-party system had never truly emerged in the subsequent era of good feelings. The ideal had prevailed that parties of any sort smacked of conspiracy and faction and were injurious to the health of the body politic in a virtuous republic. By 1840, political parties had fully come of age, a lasting legacy of Andrew Jackson's and Martin Van Buren's tenaciousness. Both national parties, the Democrats and the Whigs, grew out of the rich soil of Jeffersonian republicanism, and each laid claim to different aspects of the republican inheritance. Jacksonian Democrats glorified the liberty of the individual and were fiercely on guard against the inroads of privilege into government. Whigs trumpeted the natural harmony of society and the value of community, and were willing to use government to realize their objectives. Whigs also berated those leaders, and they considered Jackson to be one whose appeals to self-interest fostered conflict among individuals, classes, or sections. Democrats clung to states' rights and federal restraint in social and economic affairs as their basic doctrines. Whigs tended to favor renewed national bank, protective tariffs, internal improvements, public schools, and, increasingly, moral reforms such as the prohibition of liquor and eventually the abolition of slavery. The two parties were thus separated by real differences of philosophy and policy. But they also had much in common. Both were mass-based, catch-all parties that tried deliberately to mobilize as many voters as possible for their cause. Although it is true that Democrats tended to be more humble folk and Whigs more prosperous, both parties nevertheless commanded the loyalties of all kinds of Americans. From all social classes and in all sections, the social diversity of the two parties had important implications. It fostered horse-trading compromises within each party that prevented either from assuming extreme or radical positions. By the same token, the geographical diversity of the two parties retarded the emergence of purely sectional political parties, temporarily suppressing, through compromise, the ultimately uncompromisable issue of slavery. When the two-party system began to creak in the 1850s, the Union was mortally imperiled. Varying viewpoints. What was Jacksonian democracy? Aristocratic, Eastern-born historians of the 19th century damned Jackson as a backwoods barbarian. They criticized Jacksonianism as democracy run riot, an irresponsible, ill-bred outburst that overturned the electoral system and wrecked the national financial structure. In the late 19th and early 20th centuries, however, another generation of historians came to the fore, many of whom grew up in the Midwest and rejected the elitist views of their predecessors. Frederick Jackson Turner and his disciples saw the Western frontier as the fount of democratic virtue, and they hailed Jackson as a true hero sprung from the forests of the West to protect the will of the people against the moneyed interests, akin to the progressive reformers of their own day. In his famous 1893 essay, The Significance of the Frontier in American History, Turner argued that the United States owed the survival of its democratic tradition to the rise of the West, not to its roots in the more conservative, aristocratic East. When Arthur M. Schlesinger, Jr., published The Age of Jackson in 1945, however, the debate on Jacksonianism shifted dramatically. Although he shared the Turnerian's admiration for Jackson the Democrat, Schlesinger cast the Jacksonian era not as a sectional conflict, but as a class conflict between poor farmers, laborers, and non-capitalists on the one hand, and the business community, epitomized by the Second Bank of the United States, on the other. In Schlesinger's eyes, the Jacksonians justifiably attacked the bank as an institution dangerously independent of democratic oversight. The political mobilization of the urban working classes in support of Jackson particularly attracted Schlesinger's interest. Soon after Schlesinger's book appeared, the discussion again shifted ground and entirely new interpretations of Jacksonianism emerged. Richard Hofstadter argued in The American Political Tradition and the Men Who Made It that Jacksonian democracy was not a rejection of capitalism, as Schlesinger insisted, but rather the effort of aspiring entrepreneurs to secure laissez-faire policies that would serve their own interests against their entrenched, and monopolistic, Eastern competitors. In the Jacksonian persuasion, Marvin Myers portrayed the Jacksonians as conservative capitalists, torn between fierce commercial ambitions and a desire to cling to the virtues of the agrarian past. In an effort to resolve this contradiction, he argued, They lashed out at scapegoats like the National Bank, blaming it for the very changes their own economic energies had unleashed. Lee Benson contended in The Concept of Jacksonian Democracy that the political conflicts of the Jacksonian era did not correspond so much to class divisions as to different ethnic and religious splits within American society. Using new quantitative methods of analysis, Benson found no consistent demarcations in class, occupation, or region between the Jacksonians and their rivals. Local and cultural issues such as temperance and religion were far more influential in shaping political life than the national financial questions analyzed by previous historians. In the 1980s, Sean Wallace and other scholars began to resurrect some of Schlesinger's argument about the importance of class to Jacksonianism. In Chance Democratic, Wallace maintained that Jacksonian politics could not be properly understood without reference to the changing national economy. Artisans watched in horror as new manufacturing techniques put many of them out of business and replaced their craftsmanship with the unskilled hands of wage laborers. To these anxious small producers, America's infatuation with impersonal institutions and large-scale employers threatened the very existence of a republic founded on the principle that its citizens were virtuously self-sufficient. Thus, Jackson's attack on the Bank of the United States symbolized the antagonism these individuals felt toward the emergent capitalist economy and earned him their strong allegiance. The scholarly cycle came full circle with the publication of Charles Sellers's The Market Revolution, Jacksonian America, 1815-1846. In many ways, this ambitious synthesis offered an updated version of Schlesinger's argument about class conflict. American democracy and free market capitalism, according to Sellers, were not twins, born from the common parentage of freedom and opportunity, reared in the wide open young republic, and mutually supporting each other ever since. Rather, Sellers suggested, they were really adversaries, with Jacksonians inventing mass democracy in order to hold capitalist expansion in check. Like Schlesinger's thesis, Sellers's interpretation provoked a storm of controversy. To supporters, the concept of the market revolution provided a useful organizing tool for seeing social, cultural, political, and economic transformations as interdependent. To critics, Sellers's book suffered from a hopelessly romantic view of pre-industrial society and a pronounced ideological bias. In an era of tightly contested elections, they argued, no party could expect to prevail by appealing exclusively to rich or poor along class lines. The sharpest critique of the Schlesinger-Sellers thesis can be found in William Egan App, The Myth of Class in Jacksonian Democracy. Journal of Policy History. The appearance of Melvin Stokes and Stephen Conway's The Market Revolution in America, a collection of challenges and defenses, including a reply by Sellers, demonstrated that further research and analysis are needed to sort out the complex connections between democracy and capitalism and, more concretely, the motives of those Americans who spiritedly identified their own destinies with Andrew Jackson. Mexican or Texican? Moses Austin, born a Connecticut Yankee in 1761, was determined to be Spanish, if that's what it took to acquire cheap land and freedom from pesky laws. In 1798 he tramped into untracked Missouri, still part of Spanish Louisiana, and pledged his allegiance to the King of Spain. He was not pleased when the Louisiana Purchase of 1803 restored him to American citizenship. In 1820, with his old Spanish passport in his saddlebag, he rode into Spanish Texas and asked for permission to establish a colony of 300 families. Austin's request posed a dilemma for the Texas governor. The Spanish authorities had repeatedly stamped out the bands of American horse thieves and squatters who periodically splashed across the Red and Sabine Rivers from the United States into Spanish territory. Yet the Spanish had lured only some 3,000 of their own settlers into Texas during their three centuries of rule. If the land were ever to be wrestled from the Indians and civilized, maybe Austin's plan could do it. Hoping that this band of the right sort of Americans might prevent the further encroachment of the buckskin border ruffians, the governor reluctantly agreed to Austin's proposal. Upon Moses Austin's death in 1821, the task of realizing his dream fell to his 27-year-old son, Stephen. "I bid an everlasting farewell to my native country," Stephen Austin says, and he crossed into Texas on July 15, 1821, determined to fulfill rigidly all the duties and obligations of a Mexican citizen, Mexico declared its independence from Spain early in 1821 and finalized its agreement with Austin in 1823. Soon he learned fluent Spanish and was signing his name as Don Estevan F. Austin. In his new colony between the Brazos and Colorado rivers, he allowed no drunkard, no gambler, no profane swearer, no idler, and sternly enforced these rules. Not only did he banish several families as undesirables, but he ordered the public flogging of unwanted interlopers. Austin fell just three families short of recruiting the 300 households that his father had contracted to bring to Texas. The original settlers were still dubbed the Old 300, the Texas equivalent of New England's Mayflower Pilgrims or the First Families of Virginia. Mostly Scots-Irish Southerners from the Trans-Appalachian frontier, the Old 300 were cultured folk by frontier standards. All but four of them were literate. Other settlers followed, from Europe as well as America. Within 10 years, the Anglos, many of them French and German, outnumbered the Mexican residents, or Tejanos, 10-1, and soon evolved a distinctive Texican culture. The wide-ranging horse patrols organized to attack Indian camps became the Texas Rangers. Samuel Maverick, whose unbranded calves roamed the limitless prairies, left his surname as a label for rebellious loners who refused to run with the herd. And Jared Gross, an Alabama planter whose caravan of 50 covered wagons and 100 slaves arrived in 1822, etched the original image of the larger-than-life, big-time Texas operator. The original Anglo-Texans brought with them the old Scots-Irish frontiersman's hostility to authority. They ignored Mexican laws and officials, including restrictions against owning or importing slaves. When the Mexican government tried to impose its will on the Anglo-Texans in the 1830s, they took up their guns. Like the American revolutionaries of the 1770s, who at first demanded only the rights of Englishmen, the Texans began by asking simply for Mexican recognition of their rights as guaranteed by the Mexican Constitution of 1824. But bloodshed at the Alamo in 1836, like that at Lexington in 1775, transformed protest into rebellion. Texas lay, and still lies, along the frontier where Hispanic and Anglo-American cultures met, mingled, and clashed. In part, the Texas Revolution was a contest between those two cultures. But it was also a contest about philosophies of government, pitting liberal frontier ideals of freedom against the conservative concept of centralized control. Stephen Austin sincerely tried to Mexicanize himself and his followers, until the Mexican government grew too arbitrary and authoritarian. And not all the Texas revolutionaries were Anglos. Many Tejanos fought for Texas independence, seven perished defending the Alamo. Among the 59 signers of the Texas Declaration of Independence were several Hispanics, including the Tejanos Jose Antonio Navarro and Francisco Ruiz. Lorenzo de Zavala, an ardent Mexican liberal who had long resisted the centralizing tendencies of Mexico's dominant political party, was designated vice president of the Texas Republic's interim government in 1836. Like the Austins, these Tejanos and Mexicans had sought in Texas an escape from overbearing governmental authority. Their role in the revolution underscores the fact that the uprising was a struggle between defenders of local rights and the agents of central authority as much as it was a fight between Anglo and Mexican cultures.